Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 1st, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is David Christian. Today, he will be beginning his series on art. Art as a human activity, where art comes from and why. Let's listen in.
My name is David Christian, and to my left is Richard Evans. And together, the two of us are going to be doing four sessions over the course of the next week, talking about various relationships between faith and art. The way that this came about is I was on teaching staff last summer, and Richard came up and did a one-night stand on Bach, on J.S. Bach. But he attended one of my sessions and was intrigued by a couple things I had to say, and we began some conversation at that time. And we decided to try and be here at the same time and work together on some sessions relating faith and art. I'm a visual artist. I work with clay. Richard is a musician, so we come at things with a little different perspective that way. Other than being an artist, I am also the husband of a physician and the father of two boys, so that occupies my time. Richard teaches at Whitworth College in Spokane, so that occupies much of his time. But we've managed to have some correspondence back and forth to do some of the planning for this for these sessions. In point of fact, I will probably be doing the bulk of the talking and the leading for these first two sessions. Tonight, the topic is art as a human activity. Today, we really won't be talking about faith and art, but we're going to be talking about art as the possibility that it's a natural, basic human activity without consciously, overtly, obviously talking about that from a theological point of view. Tomorrow, I will again be taking the lead, and I'll try and ask some of the same questions, but looking at things from a theological point of view. Then Richard will take the lead on the third and fourth sessions, right. And do you want to say a little bit about those?
I will be talking about the way Christians use the arts to worship, and then on the last session, we'll talk about use of the arts in a society that we are told is increasingly secular, and we'll probably get into some nitty-gritty issues and have a good time on that one, just thinking about the old dualism of sacred and secular. And some of you may want to discuss things that are going on in your church, because there are lots of things going on in other denominations, let me tell you. I would just say two other things before David takes off here. We will often mention our own area as we're talking about the arts, but he may say visual art, I may talk about music, but we'd like you to apply it to the general idea of fine arts. The government defines the fine arts: music, theater, visual art, and dance. And also, the one book that we have, it's in the it's in the bookstore. We highly recommend it. It has a lot of good quotes, and it's a reflection by Madeleine Engel. We put the old classic Christ and Culture by Richard Niebuhr. We put that on reserve in the library. A couple of books that you may want to get when you go home. But Music Through the Eyes of Faith by Harold Best. From Wheaton College, this is put out by the Coalition of Christian Colleges. And then Dancing in the Dark. And these will be up here. You can get the information. This is a book published by the Institute for the Study of Youth Culture. And we'll really be addressing this on Wednesday, especially about gatekeepers, media, things going on in the commercial side of the arts and how they affect youth in the church.
I had my 45th birthday up here at Holden last week, and my mother sent another book, Calvin and Hobbes. There's treasure everywhere. I was deeply distressed last December when Calvin and Hobbes came to an end. But as I've been reading it the last few days, going through it, you know, Calvin comments on many, many things. And those of you that follow Calvin and Hobbes, I'm sure can remember some times when he has been a snowman sculptor, and it's given him a forum to talk about the arts. And one of the strips here, Calvin is standing next to a snowman that he has created, and forgive the non-inclusive language, I simply will quote what's here. He says, "Why does man create? Is it man's purpose on earth to express himself, to bring form to thought, and discover meaning in experience?" In the third panel, he is silent, holding his hand against the snowman, then rolling another snowball. He says, "Or is it just something to do when he's bored?" And I bring that up because I think the question that Calvin is asking there is one that anybody that's been involved in the arts has asked himself or herself in one way, shape, or form. There certainly are artists that are driven that have no question that what they're doing is right and useful and justifiable. But for most of us, those sorts of questions arise frequently. I ask those questions a lot. Being married to a physician whose work is more obviously and clearly valued by a lot of the culture around us. So I'm asking myself that question a lot. To get into today's discussion, I would like to get your input, your thinking process is started as well. So I'm going to lay out a couple questions for you. And I'm going to take just a minute or two of silence. I don't want just the first person to blurt out an answer, but I want you to take a minute or two to think about these questions, and then we'll be sharing some of the answers and going from that point. What I would have you consider is go back over your life and pick out one time when you think you did something that made you feel like an artist or made you feel creative. When you pick out that time, consider how did that object or performance or activity connect with other elements of your life? In other words, how did it function for you? And also, how did that object or performance or activity, how was it received by others? How did it function for an audience, even if that's just your family? So take just a few moments to think about those questions. Does anybody want to share what they came up with? Go right ahead.
Well, I went on this tour around the village with you looking at some art, which impressed me rather when you give the background of a piece of art. And I have never considered myself an artist, which I'm not, but I got up on the hill yesterday up on the top of those pilings on the third level, and I saw a flat piece of concrete. I thought about you, and it inspired me to spend the next half hour making what I think was art, probably. And in my mind, it had gone back that when I in Norway, when I crossed the Arctic Circle, it's a desolate place, if there ever was a desolate place, except for the postcard stand they got there. And people got up off of the road. There's nobody within dozens of miles, maybe 100 miles, long ways. You get up off the road, and where these markers were marking the Arctic Circle, people took a pile of stones up, and of course I did it too. I piled a pile of stones up, marking the Arctic Circle. Well, when I got up there, I took and made a cross with these stones, and then I put OSLC, Our Savior's Lutheran Church, which I'm from, and my initials, since we talked about that, not signing his art, and the year. So that's my one attempt at art. It was inspired by you.
Anybody else? Oh, I know. Yeah.
When I was in college, I took a Christian symbolism course from Arnold Flott. And I think the one of the breakthroughs for my life was the beginning point of understanding the difference between a picture and a symbol. That's kind of a life-changing thing when you look at or begin to look at symbol pointing to something deeper, more profound, more. And I think that's one of the really big changes for me. 1954, St. Olaf College.
This isn't painting, but the first time I, or that type of art, but first time I sewed a dress for one of my children that they could wear. It was a high point in my life. So.
Was that dress for a special event?
No, it was just a sundress.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes when I set a dinner table, I imagine that it's like painting a picture. I mean, I don't paint a picture, but to me that's kind of like painting a picture as you go along and set this table. And I feel that it is accepted by other people because it enhances hospitality.
Amen. Sure, go ahead.
Well, I will introduce, I have two daughters sitting next to me, grown ladies at this point. When this one was born, the other one was about 16 months. And that winter, when they were both babies in diapers and so on, I was going nuts. And I thought I would lose my mind. I thought I was very ill. I went to the doctor, and he said, I propose to you that you need something to do because there's nothing wrong with you. He suggested going back to work, which was out of the question. And so somehow I started, I became engaged in needlework. And so I did this big thing of chickens. I grew up on a small farm. I hated chickens. But in the artwork, a chicken is a wonderful art form. And with each one that I put together, it was such therapy for me. And that needlework piece hangs on the wall to this day as a reminder to me of the beauty of life, because that's what these girls ended up being for me. The miracle of what happens when life just takes over. And
there are a few more hands up. These are great examples. This is,
You started with a cartoonist gave me the courage to say my favorite kind of art is cartooning, or at least black and white. Anyway. But the earliest I can remember, when I was little, I had a magic lantern. You're familiar with those? They had. It's a projector, magic lantern projector. And my uncle, who had a barbecue, gave me the cash register roll, and I could draw my, what I call movies, on those. And had the sheet up, and I'd be, have somebody show it, and I'd be talking. But you talking about the reaction of the family, yeah, it was interesting, always to my heart. I don't think they wanted to give me too much encouragement because they thought I might end up an artist, you know? But that was the only time in my life I can ever remember. The other thing I had to do, because this projector, I had to learn to, I could write the captions backward.
Wow.
My older brother used to marvel at that. That's the main compliment I got from him, you know. Because it had to be projected back. They were the only times, I'm always one that never misses any meals, but I can remember that I was so wrapped up in drawing that I forget to eat sometimes. So I decided if I ever retired, I was going to get back into art. The only trouble is I took a lot, I got so many different things, I would go from one medium to the other kind, and never really, and still think, well, what I really like best is this sketching.
How long are you going to be here?
Were there any other hands up, or? Yeah.
One of the times I remember, I played violin growing up, and I was in a youth symphony, and we went on tour to Japan. And I remember this really overwhelming moment. It was one of our last concerts we did over there, and we played one of their pieces that was a piece that was very dear to their heart. And I remember when we were done, just about everybody was crying. And I had no idea it would have that kind of effect on the audience. It was just so overwhelming that we had given this gift to them, and it was a standing room only concert in some their civic auditorium that wasn't a really great setup, but all these people were there and they were standing with babies and all of that just listening to this concert, and it's just really overwhelming to me that people cared that much.
Go ahead.
I didn't start anything that I would classify as art, I guess, until I became old and I had time to do it. And now I have taken pleasure in taking some woods. My wife has some woods and having the lumber dried and cut up and become somewhat of an amateur woodworker, I guess. And learning the beauty of working with wood and the beauty of a piece of wood when it is finished and trying to design something that is an acceptable unit that someone can like, I have got a great deal of pleasure out of it.
I wanted to just respond quickly that Japan and Hungary are two of the countries in the world that the arts are number one. And it's not unusual that most of the great methods of teaching music are out of Japan and Hungary in this century. Mm-hmm. So there are cultures that it's very vital. It's not just an add-on. It's the core.
These were wonderful examples, and what I particularly appreciated that a number of you brought up, and I hope that we can all kind of remember the different stories that we heard, are the functions that these activities or objects or performances served. We had some talk about hospitality, that there was the art helped mediate between the guest and the host, marking a special event, birth of daughters. This notion of art, that there might be something within us that causes us to behave in such a way at certain special events is a topic discussed in a book that I have found quite interesting. It's called Homo Aestheticus, written by Ellen Dissanayake. There are not copies of this in the bookstore. It's somewhat tedious reading. It's an anthropological study. Ellen Dissanayake is an anthropologist whom I heard speak at a ceramic conference. And she somewhat not everybody agrees with her, but she makes the case that there is almost a biological necessity within the human species for art. She comes at this purely from a biological point of view. And I'd like to just share with you a very brief summary of what her argument is. She she suggests that there might be two different ways that affect the way that we think about and behave in regards to art. That there may be cultural things that we learn, or there may be natural things that are part of our genetic makeup that have simply existed, persisted throughout our development as a species. She makes the suggestion that much of what is considered smart and modern today is stuff that we have learned, and that many of those things run counter to the way the human species has behaved over 99% of its history. She therefore is interested in looking at pre-modern cultures, those that are in the world today, and at looking at anthropological digs and evidence that we have of behavior from prehistoric times, and looking to those sources for evidence that maybe art is a natural tendency within the human species. She goes so far as to suggest that it may be one of the ways in which we could define ourselves. Therefore, the title Homo aestheticus. I mean, we certainly all are familiar with Homo sapiens, wise beings. Other people have suggested we might be classified Homo faber, tool user, Homo erectus, because we stand upright, Homo ludens, because we are playful, Homo hierarchicus, because we are socially ranked, and so on. There are even more obscure titles, but she contends that we could be classified as Homo aestheticus, that it is that essential to our nature. In order to proceed with a summary of her argument, I need to give you some sense of her definition of art. She understands art as the activity of making special. So she's not concerned with the particular object, a painting, a sculpture, something like that, talking about that as being art. But for her, art is the activity, the behavior pattern within us that produces performance, music, or objects. Some of the characteristics of art, as she defines it, are that art will feel good. In order for a certain behavior to persist over time, it's going to have to feel good. And art certainly does that. Those of you who have been, especially at one of the worship Eucharists here at Holden when we've done the South African liturgy, know that when there's the dancing and the drums and people are marching around the room and there's great hooting and hollering, that would be an art experience. It is something that just plain feels good. Interestingly enough, in her book, she suggests also that, you know, that is not limited just to pre-modern cultures. She brings up some more contemporary examples. We certainly, most of us have certainly read at one point Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. She includes a little section of that. I hear the trained soprano. She convulses me like the climax of my love grip. The orchestra whirls me wider than Uranus flies. It wrenches unnameable ardors from my breast. It throbs me to gulps of the farthest down horror. It sails me. I dab with bare feet. They are licked by the indolent waves. I am exposed, cut by bitter and poisoned hail, steeped amid honeyed morphine, my windpipe squeezed in the fakes of death, led up again to feel the puzzle of puzzles, and that we call being. So certainly there is some sort of rapture or great ecstatic experience that goes on when he is speaking of listening to a soprano. So that business of art feeling good is one of the characteristics. Another one is that art is universal. As she looks across time and across cultures geographically, she finds that this activity of making special, while it occurs in different shapes and forms, exists in every culture. Even nomadic peoples who have very few possessions take the time and effort to decorate some of those possessions that they carry with them. Why does it occur? Why does this sort of activity occur? She suggests that the principal evolutionary context for the origin and development of arts was in activities concerned with survival. There are certain activities, certain events in our lives that are necessary for the survival of the species, and that art became connected to those occurrences. Birth of children being a great example of that. We find that many art objects and art rituals, performances, were connected to events of puberty and marriage, birth and death. Others were related to finding food, securing abundance, ensuring fertility, curing the sick, going to war, resolving conflict. But a significant thing to remember in all this is that the context for art, the framework for art, the reason that it came about was something that was already important for the group or for the individual. The importance was not added on later. The importance existed, and the art came to reinforce or call attention to that particular event. In some cases, the arts were used as activities to reconcile culture and nature, perhaps to help give a sense of control over nature. She talks about witnessing some Trobriand islanders who were out in a canoe in the South Seas as a storm was approaching. And if you're in a small canoe and a storm is approaching and the waves begin to rise, survival is one of your concerns. And what these islanders did is they began humming. And there was a sort of droning that was set up. Was that going to change the storm? Certainly not. But it helped bind that group together into a common purpose. And as I'm sure we all find out in our daily lives too, that when you enter into a stressful situation, one of the best things you can do is to do something. The worst thing you can do is to wait and try and figure out what to do. So that became another way that art perhaps arose out of this need to do something to give that sense of control over nature. Whether it helped or not, who knows?
Your wife would know.
That's true. The arts also were used as means of enhancement, to dress oneself up. That certainly is part of the whole business of choosing, of attracting and choosing a mate. So out of all of this, Ellen Dissanayake comes up with three conclusions. Number one, that art is a human universal need that modern society for the large part denies. Secondly, she suggests that if we consider the entire span of human history, art is both more variable in that it has many, many forms, and yet more simple. It all comes out of this basic activity of wanting to make important things special. Art is more variable and more simple than a lot of modern art theorists would perhaps lead us to believe. Her final conclusion is that the activity of making things one cares about special is fundamental, and therefore it deserves to be acknowledged, encouraged, and developed. The question that arises for me after listening to that, thinking about that, is how does that line up with our experience today? When we think about the arts today, particularly in the larger cultural scheme, I'm not talking about the examples that we gave before, Is that what people understand by art? Those sorts of activities. I'm going to lay another question upon you. And I chose my words carefully. Who is the first person that comes to mind now that I ask you to name a well-known contemporary artist? Musician, painter, dancer, sculptor, whatever. Think about that for a second. Contemporary, J.S. Bach doesn't count. Well-known, Uncle Frank doesn't count.
Bernstein.
Okay.
Hovhaannes.
Hovhaannes.
Norman Rockwell.
Okay.
Contemporary now?
Sure.
Kind of.
Sure.
20th century.
Sure.
Dolly.
Dolly. Okay, we're getting some good ones here.
Georgia O'Keeffe.
Georgia O'Keeffe.
Krishnakov.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How about Bing Crosby?
Sure. Why not?
Ansel
Adams. Okay. Now, let's think about some of these names that have come up and then ask the next question. What connection does that person or that person's work have to the rest of your life? Salvador Dali. It was a great example. What connection does Dali have to important things in your life? Probably very little. Conclusion being that if Ellen Dissanayake is onto something, art today probably is no longer serving the needs that it has served for the majority of human history. How did we get to that point? Now it's time for a brief history of Western art. How did we get to this point? In the ancient world, the Greek, and this is very quick, very much of an outline. In the ancient world, the ancient Greek and Roman world, the arts served religious and political structures. So yes, there was some carryover with the arts being related to things that were important to the community, to the group. It's interesting, though, that in the Greek and Roman eras, that the true creators, the people that were considered the inspiration for the work, were the patrons. They had the ideas. The people who actually executed are not the ones that we know about. Those are not the ones, for the most part, that were considered the artists. So already there was some individualism that was beginning to creep in. During the medieval world, religion continued to be largely inspired by religion. We think about Gothic cathedrals, so there was that connection again. This is when guilds were arising, which allowed some specialization of work. So again, when you begin to specialize, you begin to have some separation between activity and function. And the patrons were still the ones that were remembered. In the Renaissance, however, artists began to do both the intellectual work, which previously had been done by the patrons, as well as the manual activity. Whereas the patrons previously had provided something of a connection between the artist and the institutions that were served by them, when we get to the Renaissance, that begins to dissolve a little bit. We began to have more focus on the fame and prestige of the individual artists rather than just on the patrons. Then we get to the Romantic era, the 19th century. That was probably the high point of the whole notion of the artist as genius. And the whole discipline of aesthetics came into being. During that time, art began to be its own end. Art began to become much more self-conscious. It was in service to itself more than to religion or morality or government structures. And art began very loudly to proclaim its own importance. At this point, we have a clear denial of the sort of community functions that perhaps had been a part of art much earlier in our history. Then in the modern world, the trends that started during the Romantic period were carried to certain logical extremes, and the impact of the market became much greater. Art began to refer to itself much more than it did to the larger community. What do I mean by that? I discovered this, you know, when I was in graduate school doing art, the sorts of problems that we would think about that would set us about on our various investigations were related to some knowledge of art history before that. What sort of problems might this be? In some cases, a formal problem. What is the relationship of a sculpture to the space in which it exists? What delineates the space of the sculpture from the wider context? An example of a solution to that was Brancusi. You perhaps know the famous bird in space that we know from the 1960s. Did a piece where he addressed this issue of how does sculpture fit into the space with a piece called The Endless Column, which went up in a series like this. What it was a comment on sculpture on pedestals. Pedestals had been a way of mediating between the space of the sculpture and the space of the room. When you go into a sculpture gallery, you see a pedestal that sets one sculpture away from another. Brancusi said, this is an interesting thing to talk about. I'm just going to do an endless column, which has no pedestal. The piece becomes the pedestal in and of itself. Well, that's fine. I mean, that's interesting, but you can see that as art begins to refer to itself more and more like this, it becomes an arena for those that are in the know, and you have art becomes far more elite. One of the consequences of that is we have this whole new class of art-involved people called critics. And what is the function of critics? They're the ones who explain to those of us who don't know enough about art history what the art is really about. And it's a give-and-take relationship because the artists need the critic as well to help explain it so that the stuff can be sold. So it gets quite confusing, and art all of a sudden has really become very divorced from the sorts of essential concerns that probably, quite possibly, are its origins in human history. I think that's about as much as I'm going to cover with this right now. Clearly, at this point, I have not brought in any sort of theological discussion. What I'd like to do tomorrow is to deal with some of the same issues, but to say maybe instead of looking at art as something biological, is it part of our created being? How might we understand that theologically? What is there in our tradition? What is there biblically that might come up with the same conclusions that art has an essential purpose, essential function within the community?
I'd like to just say one thing as reference to music about the concept of serving the time. When I was in graduate school, my doctor advisor always was complaining, why didn't we use the music that was being composed in this century? In all previous centuries, people wrote music for its time and used it for usually a religious function. And I think that's something to think about, that we develop history, musicology, looking back, began in the previous century. And now we look back to previous times for quote-unquote comfortable styles and wonder why the music of our time doesn't really speak to us. And we'll get into some more of that in a couple of days, but it certainly backs up what David has said about some kind of gap between the use of music of its time and now. You know, we say we'd like some contemporary music. We usually mean guitars and drums and things like that. But if we really threw some really way out contemporary music, we'd probably head for the door of the narthex or something. But on the other hand, there's an educational role here too that we can work on.
Carol.
Is that, I'd like to hear the two of you talk about that very thing, because it seems to me that if art has gotten for the elite, I mean the visual arts, so the same could be true of many contemporary musicians, that there's a kind of eliteness going on here, that we're writing this in some strange scale that nobody understands, and we're showing off different kinds of instrumentation or possibly synthesized recorded sounds, yeah, slowed down and or something else. I mean, is there a kind of lack of has it gotten removed from the people?
I think I'm more reluctant than David to say that music is the elite. I think we have enough other things going on in our culture. Uh-huh. There are cultures that there are, as I already named, Hungary and Japan, and certainly Germany and France, that there's an educated process that can go on here. And I think the one thing that we haven't thrown in, at least in music, is the whole idea of the media commercialization and recordings and things like that, which have an entirely new effect. So I think in the visual art area, you have these, I love to watch these things on CNN when they have a big auction of some famous artwork and how many millions it's going to go for. I'm not sure the sketches of the Mahler 10th Symphony would sell for the same, but still get a pretty good price, the unfinished 10th of Mahler. But so I think there's another thing going on in music that have to do with valuing, and I think that's an issue he brought up, valuing of the arts, which I don't want to give away some of my preliminary material here, but the Enlightenment, we started going pretty heavily into the left brain, and even affected our theology. There are books out saying how that, like the Bible is treated like a science book, and it's the revelation of God. We've done the same with the arts, that it's doesn't fit conveniently. You summed that up when you said, my wife, science, helping people, I'm a potter. I think what we're here to say that's okay. That's part of, as Dorothy Sayers says, God and humanity have one thing in common, they like to make things.
Yeah.
And I think we'll get into that tomorrow.
Seems to me both in visual arts and in music there's a question of definitions there too. There's what qualifies as serious music versus merely popular.
Right.
And
right.
There's the division between art and craft, i.e. something that's useful.
Mm-hmm.
And those boundaries shift over time, don't they?
Yeah. Oh yeah, and that gets so complicated. In the visual arts right now, there's among theorists, we're in the postmodern era where people are taking complex literary theory and using that to apply to the visual arts and ways of looking at how do we read a text. And you look at a painting or a sculpture and consider it as a text. I mean, it makes my brain swim to begin to think about, you know, what it's talking about. But there's also increased attention being paid to the popular arts, but you also have the popular arts, the mass media, which you began to bring in.
There's tons of money in that area. To be
right. Given. And again, that, you know, that harkens, or that recalls for me, you know, Dissanayake's observation that art, as she understands it, the activity of making special, was applied to things that were already important. Whereas in our culture, there aren't that many things that are commonly understood to be important. We create things and make them important for the time being, and then we create the art around it so that we can make lots of money, and then, well, you know, then tastes shift and we move on to the next thing.
And that's, in aesthetics, there's a form of thought called information theory. Popular art is easily consumed. And, you know, when I was a kid, we had the top 40. And we just waited to get these little 45s out for the next round of rock music. Rock music hit when I was 14. And, you know, I'm a historical object. I was there when it started. but we would discard it because we wait for the next thing. Then we call standards the pieces that have a little more survival endurance with them. And so in information theory, we say, how much information do I get out of a work? Now, when I was a sophomore in high school, I listened to The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky. It took me a year to penetrate it, but I got it. But I had to keep coming back to it because it had more to it. And then we get into musical grammar, syntax, use of the elements, you know, making special. How special is it? And how intriguing is it?
So if it's harder, it's more...
Sure. Easy come, easy go. You know, making special. And of course, your question says, I think also, what do we do like a computer? User friend. Everything is getting easier, but it still takes a kid just as long to learn to play a violin and a cornet. And, you know, there's some things here that aren't going to shift with just because the culture's making things a little easier. Oh, I'm glad on my computer that's more user-friendly, because I'm unfriendly back. So I'm glad it helps me. But, I think sometimes we don't struggle. We don't try to see what's there. And part of education is to help people to see and to hear.
And in the school system, it's unfortunate that more and more any kind of the arts are just being eliminated. You know, as new schools are built, there are the computers and the technology, but there's not a piano kind of thing, you know, so that, there's value right there. Yeah.
Well, that's another issue that we'll get into our culture. We're going to talk about it as Christians tomorrow. I think David has a very wonderful presentation on that, but... yeah, there are some things that, you know, every once in a while I don't use the calculator so I can add things up in my mind to see if I can still do it. And we're talking here about affirming our humanity, that I made this, or I performed this, or I'm taking time to learn how to perform this or do it. And so there are those kinds of sociological questions of ease, user-friendly. Are there some things we still have to take time to do? And yes, it's arduous. I think you had your hand.
Yeah, more of a question of interpretation of what you said about when you asked us to name off contemporary artists, and you used the example of Salvador Dali. Why can't we have a connection to that? I mean, immediately when you said, do we have a connection to these contemporary artists, I thought, yes. I just wanted to get what you meant, she's trying to say.
Certainly, we can have, there can be a connection. The example that I read of, from Walt Whitman listening to the soprano. I mean, we can have that sort of experience, and that makes a connection. There is some relationship, but it becomes an aesthetic or a formal relationship or connection in a lot of cases. I mean, I get excited about things like Brancusi's Endless Column, but partly because survival is no longer a concern for me the way it was for our ancestors tens of thousands of years ago. It doesn't connect with our ongoing daily important activities. Is that making?
There's another concept here we just must face, and that everybody comes to the arts with a level of taste. It's very personal, and it's very set. We think this is as far as we've gone, and for that to move is often threatening. It's sort of like sometimes the level of taste. I'm dying to come to your house, ma'am, and eat at your table. I think it's wonderful. And that's a very aesthetic and artistic thing that you're doing. But everybody comes with a level. It's like the human voice. You know, if you're a singer, you're stuck with the voice. If you're an instrumentalist, we can buy a better baritone, or we can buy a better trumpet. And it's the instrument's fault. But we all have a level. And one of the things that we've been trying to do in arts education is maybe to move not on the elite, but just more connoisseurship. Because we know that we receive information through the senses, and it helps people be better students. Because we receive English and math and all those kinds of things through seeing and hearing. So it's one of those things you grow all your life, level of taste. And then we get into Christian surroundings, we have to tolerance and charity and understanding, because we all bring a different level of taste to the church.
I like that you just used the word connoisseurship, because it brought to mind a little favorite quote. I enjoy Northwest Coast Indian art. I enjoy looking at it, I enjoy reading about it. And you know, in many cases, the objects that the Northwest Coast Indians created were created for particular functions, group rituals, ceremonies, that sort of thing. And one of the books that I read described these communities as communities of connoisseurs. The art was used regularly. People saw them regularly. Maybe not daily. I'm not just talking about, you know, a spoon that you would eat out of every day, but something that you would see repeatedly and that was connected to other important events in the life of the group. Therefore, you had communities of connoisseurs. People understood things in a way that we don't right now. Just thinking about, again, Northwest Coast Indian art, I live in Port Angeles, and the Makah tribe that lives out in Nia Bay just beyond us has applied or will be applying to resume some whaling. And that's a big controversial topic. Even within the Makah people, there was a big full-page ad in the Port Angeles newspaper several weeks ago, taken out, or signed at least, by a number of the elders of the tribe saying, we are not in favor of this, even though the tribe has applied, because we have stopped the tradition of whaling. And to start it now, we are just doing it to make money. In other words, that relationship has been severed. I mean, whaling is not art, but I think it's the same thing going on here.
What spirit do you bring to this activity?
Right, right.
It's ritual, though. It may not be art, but it's definitely ritual. And I think what you're saying is that the ritual is no longer connected to
right,
life or death.
Right.
Or
it's no longer a vital ritual. Right.
Will the meaning come after the ritual? You know, if we resume this, will the meaning come back to it? I think this may be too.
Well, and the other thing these native people had in mind, they passed the ritual on. Like, is Ian Festerberg going to survive? And some of the Bach cantatas going to survive in the Lutheran church, you know?
Yeah.
What is the tradition? What is the tradition? And I have a philosopher we can quote later. I think there's a... She had her hand up. We couldn't see it in the dark up there.
Someone had mentioned earlier about the difference, the line that we create in our minds between art and craft. Uh-huh. But what you're talking about, as far as what's usable, we would now define as craft in our Western mind. Whereas, I agree, it is art.
Yeah.
We have created this artificial line between art and craft, mm-hmm. and the thing that what comes to my mind is a classic example of where money and the critics and all that gets involved is where
where people will go and pay thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars for a piece of Shaker furniture, which is created as craft very simply. But now in our minds, we think about the simple life, we put value on that, whereas the value they placed on it in creating it was religious, was totally different, you know. Their work was their worship.
Yeah.
But I think that many of these, like the Indian objects, we would define today as craft because they're useful.
Right.
And I think that's an artificial delineation between the two that we've created.
Being involved in clay, you know, I hear that argument all the time, and clay artists are really adamant in many cases to be called artists and not not craftspersons.
Right.
And yet Bach thought he was a craftsman.
When I think about visual arts, I don't think of this, but the minute I thought about the art of the dramatic arts, it seems to me that there's a great difference between, say, something that's lyric and beautiful and something that is a commentary on society. And I wonder if there's sort of our first response to what is art and what we like. It's always with a standard of beauty, which is always a personal to a certain extent. But then there are all kinds of things that are really meant to not be beautiful, but to critique whatever is perceived as being something wrong with the society. And I think that that's probably a certain something that goes through all the arts to a certain extent. And
When I started my first college career at Valparaiso, one of the first books we read was The Educated Imagination by Northrop Frye. And I remember only one line out of the book, but it was, art begins when I don't like this, begins to turn into this is not the way I could imagine it to be. And I think that kind of speaks to what you're talking about, that when you imagine the way things might be, there are a number of ways you can go with that. One is by having a beautiful model, and that certainly has been one of the main thrusts of art. But there are other ways to get at that same notion of there are other possibilities.
I liked your comment about the personal views of beauty. Certainly in the 20th century, we've had to stretch, and I think that's okay. Well, it's okay to grow. Life is journey, not arrival. So things keep coming at us, and we have to stretch and grow. It's almost time.
Shall we quit?
Well, I have something to say.
Certainly.
The opinion of people on art, I mean, you can look at something, and it doesn't look like art to you, and then you give a talk on it, and well, I understand this art. And the proof of that is that a person looks at a piece of art and they put it in a rummage sale for $2. And somebody buys it for $2 and then they discover the author. Now, looking at it didn't make it worth a million, but when they discovered the artist, it's now worth a million. So it shows you that it's kind of misleading in what you should think of a piece of art.
The effect,
you have better river sales than we do.
The effect of the market on this whole topic is just extremely complex and confusing, and it certainly muddies the picture.
The public couldn't tell by looking at
that
picture.
That's right.
Even the experts, they had to delve into it to prove that it was that artist.
Well, this is a great discussion, and I think we're going to continue with some provocative concepts as we move now tomorrow to artists as Christian, and how Christians are involved in this, and then we'll just keep narrowing it down as we move along.
3:45 tomorrow.
3:45.
Same place.
And then Wednesday's. They keep moving it earlier. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.